So I feel we are at this very, very opportune moment in computing history where computer science has gone from just like a field, like a cool field, right, within engineering, to becoming the dominant field, which is powering, right, so many aspects of how the world is run today.
Hello and welcome everyone to this particular podcast. For this particular podcast, we have with us Dr. Manish Gupta. Dr. Gupta is currently the director of Google Research in India. Prior to that, he was the vice president and led the Xerox Research Center in India, majorly working on data analytics and mobile computing projects. Before that, he was also at IBM Research in India, leading the efforts and building a lab focused on high-performance computing and business analytic projects. He also worked on the IBM BlueJeans supercomputer project early in 2000s at the IBM T.J. Watson Research Center, for which IBM received the National Medal of Technology and Innovation from the President of the United States. He also led the efforts at the Goldman Sachs developing technologies related to cloud databases and networking aiding business functions. He also co-founded and was the CEO of an educational technology startup called VideoCAN. He has received multiple distinguished awards for his efforts and contributions and has co-authored a lot of academic papers in the domains of computer science. And he has a long history of being an entrepreneur, leader, and also now a director at the Google Research in India. So thanks a lot, Dr. Gupta, for joining this for this particular podcast. And I really look forward to this conversation.
Thanks, Jay, for having me. Very happy to join.
So in order to learn more about like what kind of projects are you currently heading at the Google Research in India, and what does your work routine as a director look like, so that people can understand what kind of interests you have currently?
Sure. So, I mean, at Google Research, I mean, like any part of research, often our work spans different kinds of areas, right from working on foundational research to research that apply to existing Google products, as well as creating new products, and also research that's not tied to any Google product, where we are looking to primarily impact lives through the work that we do. So I would say even for Google Research India, we are covering the gamut of those in some sense, different paths. So we do have teams pursuing foundational research in areas like deep learning, better understanding of deep learning models, why they work, and how to make them more robust, how to make them also support some of those AI principles like data privacy and so on more effectively. To teams working on also things like understanding how human brain works, how humans make decisions. Can we kind of take inspiration from how humans think to building more effective machine learning models? To kind of work that is very driven by where we can impact the world through Google products. And there I would say, I mean, one key example would be our work on democratizing access to information in Indian languages. So we all of us, right, who kind of understand English, I feel we are, in a country like India, we are amongst the privileged lots, because to us, information, there is a lot of information at our fingertips. We literally need to simply just, type up a query in our favorite search engine, and there's a whole lot of information that we can access. But how do we democratize that kind of an access, right, to somebody, let's say, a farmer's son in Haryana or that laborer's daughter in Chhattisgarh, so that they have also access to similar kinds of information when they query in their native language. So that's kind of one key area. And then we also look a lot at, in some sense, what are some of the challenges that India is facing as a country. In particular, we see, again, agriculture being a key sector which employs like close to half of India's population is dependent on agriculture as a means of livelihood. So how can we develop and apply technology to transform agriculture? How do we, again, healthcare has become also, a very important area. I feel it's in a way like almost like a system crying for a transformation all over the world. I don't think any country in the world is happy with this healthcare system. So how can we again apply AI to transform health? So those are, again, some of the areas. And then, of course, I think in one of your earlier podcasts, I think you had my colleague Milind Tambe, who probably talked about our work on AI for social good, where we are not driven by any Google product, but working with various nonprofits who are making a difference to their communities and working on AI problems, right, that are inspired by the challenges that these nonprofits face in their work. So that's kind of a very quick summary of the kind of things we are doing at the lab.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really love that because from what I'm hearing, it's more like application oriented. So you have a particular set of applications that you want to solve. And then whatever needs to be done from a research standpoint, you are trying to build that particular foundation-based research so that we can specifically target those applications or use case scenarios. And in terms of understanding your thought process, so before that, if correct me if I'm wrong, like you were at the Xerox Research Center in India prior to joining these this Google lab. What was your thought process behind joining this? Like, why did you decide to lead this particular lab? And what can you tell us about the challenges? Because I think in a few of the interviews, you have talked about like how you led the IBM research, but it's more like it was already established and you were trying to expand it further. But in this particular case, Google was starting from scratch, starting from zero pretty much. So can you tell us about your thought process for deciding to join or lead this particular group? And what kind of challenges you see as a person who is trying to build things from scratch, but at the scale of course, Google that has a particular trademark of doing research?
Yeah. So first, a quick correction. Prior to joining Google, I was running this startup, VideoCAN. In fact, VideoCAN was a outcome of some work that we were doing at Xerox Research. So, I mean, there were a bunch of different research projects. And when Xerox went through this transition, many of us essentially licensed some initial IP from Xerox that we had developed, our team had developed, and kind of launched different startups. One of those startups which is very successful right now is Niramay, which is into breast cancer screening using thermography, applying AI to thermal images.
Yeah. Yes.
So I was leading VideoCAN, where again we were applying AI to learning videos to again make them more easy to consume, and more engaging. So to me, I mean, initially it was kind of when I was approached by Google. Initially, I mean, it wasn't an easy decision because I kind of was quite focused on my startup and I wanted to ultimately make that work. At some level, I then also recognized that, I'm more of an accidental entrepreneur. I realized that in the early stages of a startup, probably there's, a much bigger need for the CEO, right, to be much more business-driven rather than very technology-oriented, the way I was. So at some point, I felt that perhaps even VideoCAN would be better served by having a more business-focused CEO. And what was attractive about this opportunity with Google was, I have the sense that we are at this very unique moment in computing history, I would say. See, because I'm this dinosaur, right? I was born in the year that Moore's Law was proposed, right? 1965. And we've been on this journey, right? As a consequence of kind of what was predicted by Gordon Moore, the technology industry, right, has been working very hard to make his prediction come true, right? With this doubling number of transistors,
the number of transistors,
the capability, right? So the capability, the computational capability, right, of all these chips has advanced exponentially over the years in accordance with Moore's law. And I think what that has led to is, even though Moore's law is now slowing down considerably, what those like decades of exponential advances have done for the field is that from this very like a niche area, I mean, when I started my education in computer science, my BTech in computer science at IIT Delhi, I mean, believe it or not, I'd never seen a computer at that time. Computers weren't that ubiquitous, right? And the World Wide Web didn't exist, right? So we have come such a long way. So I feel we are at this very, very opportune moment in computing history where computer science has gone from just like a field, like a cool field, right, within engineering, to becoming, in some sense, right, the dominant field, which is powering, right, so many aspects of how the world is run today. So I feel very fortunate that we are in this, that we computer scientists, right, are in this profession that allows us to have impact on the real world. So I also feel we are at this moment that today we have so much of computational power available at our disposal at a very low cost, that if we are passionate about any problem, right, you pick any problem that the world is facing or your community is facing, I mean, at any end of the spectrum that you are passionate about, I wouldn't say you can solve the problem, but you can, I mean, make a significant difference, right, to that problem with the help of computing. So to me, that is what is very exciting, that we are at this very interesting point where we can make a real difference with the work that we do as computer scientists, and being able to lead such a team, right, at Google Research, which is really, again, at the forefront of computing research and has this very, very progressive outlook, right, on wanting to make a difference, right, to the world. I just found that to be ultimately a really compelling opportunity, right, to hopefully make a difference. And I also see that as a responsibility, right, that we have ahead of us, that we have to do justice to that opportunity through our work.
Right. Yeah, no, I completely second that. And like you also referenced this particular podcast that I had with Dr. Tambe. And before I had this, before he, I think, joined even Google Lab, he was involved in a lot of projects that had kind of an impact. And that was actually very, very, very surprising and nice feel good moment for me, where we actually see that, okay, these kind of technologies that we learn as a grad student or as a researcher or as a PhD student, that actually has some kind of impact that we can achieve or at least aid certain other interdisciplinary sciences. And that was something really, really nice. And I think that seconds the idea that how you are trying to bring that particular ideology at Google Research Lab in India. So I really love that idea. And it's correct. Like the power that has increased, like it has enabled us to at least create some applications that can create a difference, what we were doing before and how we can improve that or at least scale that to a majority population. So I really love that idea. Yes. But in terms of your particular career, so you have been a researcher, you were a PhD student, you were a researcher over here at IBM, then you transitioned to a managerial role, entrepreneur role, and now you are at a director level where you are leading efforts. In terms like for us as naive students who have not seen the field much enough or we don't have exposure, can you explain what are the differences between being a researcher, be it an academic student or working at some industry, then being a senior researcher where you are leading efforts, they are basically guidelining the whole project, versus something like you, as in where you are actually managing multiple projects, you are worrying about the applications, you are worrying about how to hire people and which people to hire and whatnot. And also being at the junction of working with some industry, then people and also projects, like multiple, I think there are multiple modalities that you might be handling. So can you explain the differences? What are the differences as a person when you are wearing these different hats?
Right. So I would say, first of all, I think it's really amazing being a student. So in a way, I would also say being a student is one of the most enjoyable parts of your life. I'm sure you relate to that. Because as a student, I think you can be very focused. I mean, when you're, let's say, pursuing a PhD, you're usually very focused on that particular PhD problem, right? That you're trying to come up with innovative ways of solving that problem and better ways, more systematic, very systematic and better ways of solving that problem than anybody else has, right? Previously.
Right.
And that is what you try to do as a student, especially as a PhD student. Then when you go and start working, let's say in an industrial research organization, one of the things you have to do is you have to align your goals with the broader goals, right, of the organization and ideally also of the company. Because if you are able to align those goals, if you are working on something that your company cares about, something that your organization cares about, you get that kind of amplifying impact, right? I mean, you get that that force like that multiplicative factor, right, from the support that your organization provides. And one of the ways in which that organization provides that support is through collaborators. So again, I mean, I've been fortunate enough, right, to right from early, like early in my career, I had this opportunity to work with kind of really stalwarts in the area. I mean, the senior manager of my team at IBM Research was Fran Allen, who was the first woman to be an IBM fellow. She later became the first woman to win a Turing Award. And there was this team of, again, amazingly kind of like the leaders, right, in their field, in the area of, I was doing research on compiling for parallel machines. So it was kind of amazing to be working alongside some of the leaders, which inspired you, right, to also be like them, right, to be amongst the best in the world in your field. So always, I mean, that goal, to me early in my career, the goal was that at least for the areas, right, that I'm working on, hopefully, right, I should aspire to be amongst the best researchers in the world. At least that was the driving, kind of one of the driving factors, and also achieve impact, right, on the organization's goals and on the company's goals. And as you kind of do further work, right, in an industrial research lab, you realize that you can have ultimately bigger impact if you can kind of combine your work, right, with those of others around you. And if you can start to influence, right, the work of other researchers also, and together, you are able to achieve much bigger things, right, than you are able to do just by yourself, just as an individual. So I think a lot of then kind of some of that natural progression at an industrial research lab is where you're trying to kind of provide greater levels of leadership. And I feel a lot of that comes from being able to figure out what are the right problems to solve. We often say in research, right? I mean, sometimes the hardest part is identifying the right problem, right, to work on. Then solving the problem sometimes is the easier part. I would say that's even more true, right? In an, let's say, industrial research setting, it is extremely important for you to figure out the right problems to solve. And if you're able to kind of think ahead, right? And if you are able to pose the right kind of problems, right, that are worthy of being solved, where you as a team, right, not just you as an individual, but also with others, you can together work on solving those problems, right, and make a difference to, let's say, your company's mission, to the world at large, and so on. It sets you up, right, for success. So I think you start to have all of those kind of opportunities then for showing your leadership. And sometimes in the initial stages, you also, and sometimes even in later stages, you also have to learn to influence other people, even if you are not the manager. So one of the always kind of goals you have is that, look, even, I mean, because what I say sometimes is, which I encourage all of the young researchers that I work with, is that especially early in your career, you should not be too worried about all these labels. I would say even later in your career, but especially early in your career, you should not be so hung up on these labels. Am I a team lead? Am I a manager? And so on. Because in my view, leadership shows up in the work that you do. Because if you are doing high quality work, if you are proposing new ideas, if you are coming up with new directions on where the team should be going, and if you're able to convince the rest of your teammates that yes, that's the right direction, right, to take, you need not be the assigned leader, right? You are showing leadership through your actions. So this is how I think young researchers and junior researchers can get started, start to show that impact. And at some point, right, the organization recognizes the leadership that you're showing, and you often are then appointed to those kind of positions. And then you realize there's a lot more, right, to getting things done, right, rather than only the technical work. Because there is a great deal of work that you do in attracting the right kind of people, in building the right kind of teams, and ensuring, right, that different team members, right, are able to work harmoniously, right, together in pursuit of a goal, right, that is larger than each of the individual goals, right, that we all have. So I think that kind of usually, I would say, progression often happens naturally. That's been my journey.
Yeah, no, I think these are very useful insights, as in, because I can relate to few of them, but again, I'm a much, much lesser experienced researcher, but at least I can see the value where you pointed out a few things is the idea of working in, like, transitioning from being a researcher to identifying the problems, right, like which needs to be worked on. And I think this is something I realized when I started my PhD projects last year. And I was actually confused when a lot of senior researchers would tell me, like, which kind of projects we really need to work on. So me being a very naive researcher, I would just jump onto the deep learning part, right? Like programming or coding and everything stuff. But when I presented those works at few conferences and people approached me and asked more about the problems, as in what kind of problem I'm trying to solve, only then doing some homework, I realized, okay, this is actually efforts from a lot of people over the years where they identified which problems to work on, as in, like, which data sets to use, which application we are trying to harmonize, or which kind of synthesis we want to do. And that particular is the key idea, or I would say the most MVP of a project. Me building a deep learning model was maybe the last thing people need in the research community, because that's just the one last point. So I think I see the value as in how people can progress being in the field and then understanding, okay, this is not solved, this versus this is solved, and what problems we can solve and that needs to be solved. So I think, yeah, I really love that idea. So I can see the value where you're pointing at. So yeah. And jumping back to the same idea, as in, like, the focus of Google Research Lab in India, and this is, I think this would be the question that we can transition to a different topic, is I think a majority of the focus, even when I talk to Dr. Tambe, is more on the explainability or robustness of AI models. And also what you said, this is much more application oriented, as in not from a very breadth of a topic's perspective, but more on the application oriented. You pick out few problems and you want to solve them in a very concrete sense. So, but from what I have heard and what I have seen the industry publishing work, the idea of interpretability, explainability, and robustness is very fairly new. As in, we do understand what we want, but we don't understand from a technical perspective. So based on your experience leading this lab, how would you, in technical or non-technical, feel free to choose whichever, but in which terms, how would you define robustness? As in, what kind of idealistic perspective you can paint for people to at least grasp on and see, okay, this is what we want. This is what the applications want that are not related to computer science, but how, if we are going to use AI and we call them robust AI, what they should look like, at least in the next 5 or 10 years. So what's your ideal definition you would give for robustness?
Yeah, so at least the lens that we apply in a lot of our work is how do you make these models robust to, for instance, shifts in data distribution, right? Because, as you know, typically you start with training the models on certain training data that you have. And as you build these models and test them, after you've tested them successfully, you deploy them on the real world. Right now, as you deploy them in the real world, the data that they are encountering in the real world, A, it could be different from the kind of data that these models were trained on. And B, even if it is not different initially, over a period of time, right, it could be different. So I'll explain that with like maybe one, maybe I'll use a couple of examples, right, from some of the practical side of what we are looking at. I mean, we are, again, motivated by the India context. We see India has kind of now become the number two country. I mean, it's been for a while in terms of internet usage. And the way it became number two, overtook the US in terms of number of people accessing the internet, was primarily based on the usage of smartphones. So India has like over 600 million internet users. And most of them are accessing the internet, not through desktop computers and so on, but through smartphones. Now, and many of these users, smartphone is the first such device. So these are new internet users. Smartphone is the first such device that they are, digital device that they are using. So often we think about how would you make that device easier to use, more useful, and so on, right, to these users. And one of the things that you would like to do is support things like maybe conversation, right? Instead of me having to work through the various screens in Android and figuring out how to set certain settings, how to change certain settings, and how to, again, start a particular application and so on, it would be nice if I could simply issue a voice command and kind of have the phone do it. And furthermore, it would be nice if I can communicate with the phone in my native language rather than having to speak English. So now if you think about, let's say, the ML models that you want to deploy on these phones, I think there are very interesting set of challenges. I mean, and one of them is on this robustness, right, that you just mentioned. Because A, the kind of public data sets on which typically, let's say, automatic speech recognition or whatever, any NLP models and so on, right, are trained, are very different from the data, right, that you're going to encounter when you deploy them on these smartphones, because the characteristics and typical data patterns, right, for these users is very different from often like data sets which are sourced from the West, from what goes on in the West and so on, right? So A, even the initial kind of production data is often very different from the kind of standard data sets that often get used for training such models. And B, you're also going to see a lot of variability, like things in terms of, let's say, speech recognition, speech to text. There's going to be so much variation in the kind of accents that you're going to encounter. So how do you kind of support that? So that would be kind of one set of driving applications. The other, I mean, as we think about also, I mean, things like robustness and explainability, you also think about some of the critical areas like health. When you apply AI to health-related problems, you don't want to make mistakes, right? I mean, that are going to lead to bad outcomes for people, right? I mean, it is fine, right, for an AI model to make a mistake when you're doing whatever, let's say, algorithmic trading, or you're figuring out the right ad to show. Look, if instead of the right ad, I saw a different ad, it's not the end of the world. However, if the machine learning algorithm makes a different recommendation, right, let's say, it looks at my medical image, my chest x-ray, and says, oh, you're fine, you don't, and I actually have, let's say, a serious issue, let's say there's some malignancy, and the machine learning model says, no, there's no such thing. I mean, that can be an extremely harmful kind of a recommendation, even though these are only recommendations to the doctors, but if the doctor is influenced by the output of that machine learning algorithm and makes a bad decision, it is going to cost, right, a lot. So robustness becomes even more important, right, in areas like health. So there, one of the lenses we are taking is, can we at least calibrate these machine learning models, estimate the uncertainty of these deep learning models better? Can we at least, even if we can't make this algorithms work well on all kinds of data, can we at least have this algorithm recognize, oh, on this data, I'm not so confident about my prediction, right? Because, and we know humans do that all the time, right? Human doctors, when they see a complicated case, a human doctor would say, this is a complicated case. Let me consult another colleague and get a second opinion. And likewise, I mean, as students, when we are given a tough exam, I mean, we know that we don't know the answer, right, to a tough question. So we as humans know what we don't know, but deep learning models often very confidently give out the wrong prediction. So can we at least train the model? I mean, can we at least kind of calibrate that model and have it convey that, look, I'm not so sure in this case. So it's better for the human to make a decision completely disregarding what I'm telling, the recommendation, right, that or prediction that I'm making as an algorithm for this case, right? So those are some of the different kind of lens through which we have looked at this problem of robustness. And likewise, explainability is the other thing that you mentioned. I mean, again, back to that medical imaging example, you would ideally like the algorithm to also be able to explain its predictions. Why has it said that there is a case of malignancy? Can it also identify that region where it believes there's that tumor is malignant? Or in case of, let's say, text kind of language related tasks, when the system is recommending something or it is kind of giving you a certain answer, let's say you have a search query, and when it answers, provides you a response, can it also do attribution? That, look, I'm saying whatever, let's say this COVID vaccine is this particular safe because of here are the sources. Here are the reliable sources, right? Based on which, right, I am sharing this particular answer, right? So when you're answering a question, can you also provide attribution in let's say an NLP task? Those are all moving us towards greater explainability, and I feel down the road they also will lead to more robust systems, right? Because I mean, you're more grounded in hopefully reality and truth that way.
Right. So from what I can take away from this is making techniques that can hold these deep learning models or machine learning models accountable for whatever confidence intervals they are predicting or outputting. As in, even if they're uncertain, please let us know how much uncertain you are or how much certain you are, and possibly an explanation of why they are doing that. So if that would be a loose definition of robustness, I think that would be something really important. And I really like that. But I think you mentioned a breadth of topics that have a lot of impact. And I also, again, citing back to the podcast with Dr. Tambe, I wanted to learn more about, like, how do you decide which products do you work on? As in, you, like, I also come from India, so I know there is a variety of applications, variety of problems that can be solved, because the problems are endless. But in terms of AI applications, we can either solve all of them or maybe none of them. So how do you decide, like, which projects interests you versus which is possible versus that aligns with Google Research interest versus you have people who can actually make a difference working on those projects? So how do you manage these multiple entry points and try to finalize a project that you might be working on for the next few years?
No, that's actually an excellent question. And I think it's a very important one, because what I feel, again, having been also a graduate student and as I joined kind of industry in my early years, I mean, I can relate to what often goes on in the mind of a young researcher. I mean, I remember when I graduated with a PhD, I mean, I was very excited about that particular area and I wanted to solve further problems right in that area. And that's a very natural thing, because, and often this is how we as researchers choose problems. We have certain area of expertise, and often our research interests are aligned with that expertise. And sometimes what we do is we say, oh, we look at the available literature and we say, okay, existing state of the art is able to solve this problem. Let me pick a problem which is not adequately addressed, right, by the existing state of the art, which I believe I can solve, right? And therefore, I will be able to write a paper, right? I will be able to claim, here's my advance, right, over the previous state of the art. I'll be able to write a paper. Everybody will be happy. So often, kind of, we have a tendency, right, to choose problems on that basis. What's that delta, right, to the existing state of the art, which I'm A, interested in, which I'm reasonably confident I can solve. And I would say it is fine to be in that mode sometimes, but if that is your dominant mode, you're really missing out on something much bigger. Because in my view, the right way to pick problems is to answer a series of so what questions, right? You say, okay, I say I want to solve this problem. So you should be asking me, so what? I mean, what would happen? I mean, if you were to solve that problem, then I give a response. And I think then you should ask another so what question. Okay, I mean, yeah, I mean, I say, let's say I say, oh, I'll build multilingual models. So what? I mean, what will happen? Oh, this way, farmer's son that I was talking about, that laborer's daughter, she would also be able to, in some sense, access information in her native language. You ask another so what? And then I give another response based on that, saying, look, this is going to now make so much of a difference, right? It could improve whatever this girl's learning ability. She could now become much more successful in her career. And so after a series of these so what questions, if you end up with answers that suggest that the impact is going to be significant, in my view, that's a problem worth solving. Because if after a series of so what, you end up with something which, yes, I mean, maybe improves things a little bit by a small degree for a small set of people and so on, perhaps the problem is not worth going after, right? I'm not making a judgment call, it's not worth solving, but I mean, with your limited time, with your finite amount of time that you have, right? In your lifetime and so on, perhaps you should be focused on bigger problems. So now a problem with some of these bigger problems is you realize, look, I don't have the skills, right? I don't have the ability to solve that bigger problem by myself. So A, it puts you now, in some sense, it takes you out of your comfort zone when you pick these larger problems. And one of the things that you have to do is not just solve the problem, try to solve the problem alone. You have to now team up with other people, and often team up with people who have complementary expertise to what you have. Because sometimes also we have this very tendency, right, that, I work on natural language processing, or I work on computer vision. Let me work with other researchers also in computer vision. And yes, we kind of advance, right, this state of the art. And also that is how we often structure even teams, right? I mean, we have people with computer vision expertise all working together and so on. I think every once in a while, you should also be looking at, okay, here's this big problem that I want to solve, which is going to require expertise, not just in computer vision, it will require natural language processing, it will require HCI expertise, it will require some social science kind of a background, maybe some economics, ideas from economics, and maybe, likewise, when I'm looking at the world of healthcare, maybe it requires some medical kind of domain expertise and so on. So when you're solving these bigger problems, A, you really need to start to bring together, right, and start collaborating with people who bring complementary expertise to what you have. And I would say it's often, right, in your career, you should be working on such more ambitious problems because of two reasons, right? One is that your rate of learning is much higher when you work on these challenging problems outside your immediate comfort zone, because you're learning so many new things often right from your teammates who bring that complementary expertise. So even if you fail at that project, right, in that project at solving that problem, you have still learned a lot, right? So even if you fail, often it is worth it to work on those challenging problems because you are learning so much. And many of these failures, right, are paving the way for bigger success down the road. And the other aspect is that if you succeed even once or twice, the recognition that you get from the community, which is what often researchers crave for, but more importantly, ultimately, it's also the sense of self-satisfaction. Your own sense of self-satisfaction is going to be much higher when you come up with good solutions to a meaningful problem than when you only do some incremental work and yes, you've got that paper published and when you look back upon your career and you say, oh, I've written all these 100 papers, if those are all incremental papers, I can assure you, you're not going to get that same sense of satisfaction as you would get even if you have solved, let's say, even if you have solved one problem that really made a big difference, right, to the world, you're going to feel much greater sense of satisfaction. And of course, I would also say, I encourage the young researchers to take a longer term view. And I also, honestly, we are all also motivated often by the recognition, fame, and so on. I mean, if you look at kind of people getting major awards, right? When people get major awards, let's say like Nobel Prizes and other fields, Turing Award in the area of computing, they get these major awards, right? Usually for one defining accomplishment, right? Or a very small set of major accomplishments, right? Nobody gets a major award, because they've written 500 papers that have 500,000 citations. Nobody gets a major award for just producing a body of work. People get major recognition for making really like outstanding contributions to a few major problems. And I would say even you get a lot more satisfaction out of that, which is why and often that doesn't come naturally to us. The natural tendency often is to work on those incremental kind of problems, which is why I think that this is very, very important. And something to be very, very deliberate about when you are pursuing a research career.
I love this perspective, and there's nothing much I can add, as in because I think I'm still in that very minimalistic short view. But I think from what I understand is like it's important to zoom out a bit and see what kind of impacts we can do. And if the impact is very less, then maybe it's not worth solving, or maybe we can have a lesser bandwidth to that particular project. But it's important to zoom out and see what is the bigger charter that we can address and start working on that. Because it's like, even if you're working on big project, if it doesn't happen to be the best thing, but at least you did something better than the smaller impacts that you have. So I really love that thing. Yeah. This is something I realize can only come from senior people, because we as students, we don't have the breadth of exposure for the entire field, let alone computer vision or AI, which is like rapidly developing. So I think this is very important for us to hear that, okay, please zoom out and work.
I want to correct you over there. I mean, I shouldn't say use the word correct you, but I mean, I beg to differ, because sometimes I feel younger people are capable of much bigger things than older people like me, and most of the time I would say, see, because when you are a junior researcher and so on, right, one of the strengths you have is you're not burdened by conventional wisdom. Because one of the things that often affects as you kind of get entrenched in a given field, while on one hand you kind of gain that experience, all those insights and so on, one of the things that happens is you get too embedded in the conventional way of thinking about it, right? Yeah. Because you've been thinking about that problem for years and you're talking to these other researchers who are also thinking about these problems for years and so on, right? So sometimes it makes your perspective a bit stale. And the power of young researchers is you don't have that problem of being burdened by conventional wisdom, right? So often, you guys who are young, you have some big advantages over people like me, right? Who are more senior, more experienced, and so on, right? So, which is why I wanted to challenge you that don't think that you have to whatever have those years of experience and so on, right? Before you will really be able to accomplish those big things. No, often young researchers achieve breakthroughs that elude experienced people. And in fact, there is that theory, right? There is that, try to remember what was that book, Medici Effect, which had that kind of a claim that most breakthroughs, right, in the history, in our human history, have come from either very young people or people who were new to a field. That they may have been experienced, but they were new to a field. And the reason they were able to come up with those breakthroughs is because they weren't burdened by conventional wisdom. So I don't want to get into the debate. Look, there are plenty of also breakthroughs that have come from very experienced researchers. So I don't want to minimize that. But there is that line of thought, right, which has a certain merit to it. And so don't underestimate your own capability, right, as a young researcher. And so don't be afraid to dream big and achieve those big things.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely. Yeah. It's a nice way to put it like that. Yeah. I agree. And one other question I think specific to India that I want to cover to the last is the idea we talked about how we are working on challenges that are specific to India. But I want to learn, like, have you had particular encounters for challenges that are specific to India? Because when you're working on these projects which are specific, originating from India, what kind of challenges that have you seen that are imposing, and how are you trying to solve those challenges? Because I realize when you're working on these kind of unsolved problems, there is no textbook, right? So you might be facing in terms of data collections, working with people, working with collaborators who are not from computer science domain. And this would be specific to India because the way how that they are organized over there in India. So what kind of challenges have you seen are the most common ones? And what would you have any tips on those kind of challenges for other people who are not affiliated with Google, but who want to do something similar, they can actually replicate from your insights?
Yeah, so see, I mean, when we pick problems, let's say, and examples being, let's say, we are looking at this problem of access to information in Indian languages, or when we look at kind of some of these problems, right, that these nonprofit organizations, right, our partners in that AI for Social Good program have raised, a very common theme to many of these kind of some of the challenges that appear in the scenario is often you don't have enough resources, right? So because again, machine learning, typically, right, models thrive on a lot of labeled data being available, right? So whenever you have lots of labeled data available, it becomes much easier, right, for you to build, again, amazing models. So often one kind of a common challenge is you don't have, I mean, the amount of labeled data that you have available, let's say for Gujarati, if I'm trying to do speech to text for Gujarati, is much, much lower, right, than what I have available for English. And therefore, again, my levels of accuracy, or if I'm trying to translate Gujarati text into English, because of the overall corpus of text that I have access to, is much lower, I'm going to face that challenge, right? So one is, often resources. Another big challenge often that we find in India is the scale, because anything to do with number of people, you find, I mean, you need to solve that problem for hundreds of millions of people. Another common thread is often like resource is also even hardware resources. So I gave that example of working on smartphone, low-cost smartphones. So when you look at low-end smartphones, I mean, the amount of computational power that they have is much lower than the high-end smartphones, because high-end smartphones now these Pixel phones, right? They are coming with even these TPU chips, TPU-based accelerators, which can dramatically kind of improve the performance of machine learning workloads. So when you don't have as much of computational power, as much of memory, and so on, right? So low resource. So low resource sometimes in terms of data, sometimes in terms of the hardware resources that you have available. Much bigger challenge. Often the data tends to be very noisy. You don't have clean data available. Sometimes you don't have data available in electronic form to begin with, right? So, I mean, if we look at, for instance, healthcare data, a lot of healthcare data in India is in these handwritten prescriptions by doctors. It is not in electronic health records. So how do you start with that kind of a data, right, and put it into digital form so that your machine learning algorithm, right, can even start to do something about that data? So you find a lot of these challenges. And I would say, I rarely have encountered something which was only specific to India, right? Because typically, the nice thing is when you work on some of these challenges, and if you solve these problems in a principled manner, often you can come up with solutions that are going to be useful, not just in India, but would be relevant, right? Also for many parts of the world beyond India. Because if nothing else, you will find maybe many parts of Africa, many other parts of Latin America, and so on, right? Where you're dealing with very similar challenges of, let's say, not enough resources being available, or not enough digital resources, data in digital form, and so on, available. And there are other challenges where I feel if you innovate, motivated by the Indian context, you're going to do something which is relevant for the entire world. So if I look at healthcare, my view is the future, the real action in healthcare in the future is going to be outside the formal healthcare system, right? Outside the hospitals. Because often when we think about healthcare, we think about the doctor's office, we think about the hospital, and so on. And as one of my colleagues once said, those are really sick care systems. And the future of healthcare is in true healthcare, where you are working with healthy people and you are trying to keep them healthy. So, and there's so much of a burden of disease today, right? Which is from lifestyle diseases and so on. So my view is the real action, a lot of the real action in healthcare in the future is going to be before you get to the hospital, right? When you're living your normal life at home and at work and so on, right? And we are seeing that future already, right? We are seeing all these wearables through which so much of our body vitals data can be collected. There are mobile phones, there are all these apps. I can now point the mobile phone to my face and it can uncover my respiration rate and my heart rate and all kinds of parameters, right? Body vitals. So a country like India, which doesn't have a very well-developed formal healthcare system, we don't have too many hospitals, we don't have even too many primary healthcare centers which are staffed with medical doctors. So I'm not suggesting that those are not important. Of course, India needs to make progress in terms of building more hospitals, having more doctors available for our population, for our needs, and so on. But I'm saying there's an even bigger need in a country like India to build those, to have that focus on preventive health, on wellness, so that you reduce the pressure on this formal healthcare system. And we have seen kind of that illustrated so much, right, in the pandemic, because everybody recognizes, right, that it's far better to try and avoid getting COVID rather than then getting yourself treated once you have COVID, right? So there's that saving, prevention is better than cure. So that is the future of kind of health. So I believe there are many such areas where even if you are initially motivated by the unique challenge or whatever unique sounding challenge in India, you will end up hopefully doing work which is relevant to the rest of the world too, And many of these problems, when we think about like low resources and kind of large scale and so on, they push you towards novel ways of solving those problems, right? Which can be meaningful research contributions, right? In their own right. Yeah. So it's often kind of a very kind of a worthwhile and satisfying thing, right? To be able to work on problems that are motivated by the Indian context, because often that is allowing you to do work, right? Which is kind of world class.
Yeah, no, I really love that. As in, like, you're trying to build and focus more on digital solutions that can prevent these things before happening, and that can eventually have a cascading effect on improving the healthcare systems. And I also like that, because I think when I talked to Dr. Tambe, he also mentioned that actually working on these challenges from only the challenge perspective also inspires a lot of creativity from the foundational perspective, how we can develop models specific to that. And like you said, those models can be used in different contexts, not even just for healthcare in India, but they can be used for a very different problem, but nobody had thought of that particular problem in that sense. So yeah, I think yeah, challenges do inspire the foundational perspective of computer science research overall. So yeah, I love that. And one other question in concrete terms I have is, these kind of projects, when you work, and like you said, as we start off as a young researcher, the only focus is trying to beat the state of art, right? Like trying to even just like a 5% of increase is kind of a big deal, and we try to celebrate that. But in these kind of projects, when you are working on much more subjective definitions, right, you are working with people on real world scenarios where people are getting affected, or I think wildlife and a lot of other problems which do not have a clear mapping in terms of performances. How do you define, or how do you understand the metrics when you're working on these projects, that, hey, this project is doing good versus this is doing moderate, or actually this is making things worse? How do you define? In terms of numbers, we know how we can do it. There are tons of mathematical formulas we can do that. But in this case, I think it has to be a subject basis scenarios. You have to factor in for a lot of informations. How do you typically, on an average, define metrics for success and of the
projects? Typically, what you do is, at a very high level, you try to have metrics more in terms of, so for instance, when I look at it at a lab level, I have a particular metric that through our work, we want to impact over 1 billion lives in a positive manner, right, on the planet. So that's a very high level, in some sense, goal and a metric. But when you work on then specific problems, then you try to boil it down into more measurable things that you can do. So for instance, back to Milan's work as part of the AI for Social Good, with one of the nonprofits, Arman, that we've been working with. So Milan and his team, they have kind of now done randomized controlled trials with tens of thousands of people, right? And shown in a very rigorous manner that, yes, the level of engagement you're having with the expecting mothers and the outcomes that you're going to achieve for those expecting mothers is going to be better as a result of your algorithm, right? Your, let's say, restless multi-armed bandits-based algorithm, which is being used to identify which women should receive a call from a human volunteer, that it is actually leading to greater level of engagement. So it is lowering the dropout of women from that program. And in fact, it is ultimately leading to better health outcome, right, for these people. So yes, I mean, when we get down to specific projects, then we try to come up with more concrete, measurable metrics so that you're able to, at least stay true to yourself that, yes, you have actually made a positive difference.
I love that. I love that. Switching gears a little bit, I want to switch to the idea of you being as a researcher. Now we can, like, putting away the Google hat over for a minute is I want to learn more about your thoughts as a young researcher versus a senior researcher. So you moved back to India after a long streak of career that you had at IBM, right? And like you said, you had different transitions of being a PhD student, then a researcher, senior researcher, and then a manager at IBM, where you worked on the a very big project, I think Eugene supercomputer project. So what was your thought process? Because on a majority, if we see the majority people who stay over here in the United States or basically anywhere out of India, they typically tend to stay over there, that particular location. But you tried to move back, you had a lot of other thoughts. So I want to learn, what factors did you personally consider for moving back to India, and what factors motivated you to go back into the first place?
Yeah, so one of the motivating factors was always to make a real difference. And I remember being very influenced by when I was an undergraduate student at IIT Delhi. I remember once there was a speaker who had made a similar transition, who had moved from the US to India. And that speaker made this very interesting statement. He said, in the US, I was operating at this high level. And and after returning to India, maybe because of whatever resource constraints and so on, those were also very different days. He said, okay, I'm operating at a lower level, right, in terms of technology or whatever, lower level, maybe in terms of absolute output, in terms of my research output. But he said, if I look at kind of the impact I was having, right, on the world through my work in the US, right, I would make maybe this delta impact, whereas in India, through my work, I can have much bigger. I can have much bigger impact, right? So he said, your sense of satisfaction is actually driven, right, more by the delta that you are able to create rather than the absolute kind of level of your output. So even if the absolute level of output perhaps had been higher in the US, because I'm able to make a bigger difference in India, I find it more satisfying to be back in India, right? So I mean, I was for a long time influenced by those words, right? That I heard, and I literally, I experienced that after moving to India, because I feel that in a lot of different ways, right? So as we were contributing and so on, I felt there was much bigger opportunity to make a difference to the real world around me through the work that we were doing. So that has been a very satisfying part of being back in India.
Yeah. I can see the value this comes from. So yeah, I definitely like that, and I hope people actually consider this particular perspective that you had back in mind and consider doing that. I think yeah, that's really important. And in terms of learning more for the students, so you mentioned a lot of quiet different things, I think zooming out and focusing on impact that could have long-term benefits, which is a nice perspective for even young researchers or senior researchers to have. What kind of other skills you would tell, or maybe a young researcher who is trying to maybe make his or her career into academia or industry, that are typically not a part of the textbook, or that is not typically being learned very straight away, but people learn over the time. What kind of skills, apart from being technical expert at something, what skills would you say you look for researchers ideally, that hey, this is something I learned in my long time career, but this is something one should always learn apart from being great at what they are doing, that helps in the collaboration process or working in teams or something like that? Any kind of skills that are not part of the textbook?
I would say one is, I think, being curious, being very driven, being very motivated by something bigger than your own personal cause. And I think always being willing to learn more, because the world keeps changing, that technology keeps advancing, right? So just because you're an expert at something is not going to serve you, right, for too long unless you keep learning new stuff, mm-hmm. right? So I think that part about, again, always, I mean, being willing to learn and willing to go out of your comfort zone, stretching yourselves, right, to go after these bigger goals and so on. I mean, that I would say would be kind of one key thing, apart from, of course, kind of building that expertise. And building that expertise often, I mean, people talk about this T-shaped individual concept that you should have good breadth, just like that top part of T, but also depth. At least there should be one area where you really have much greater level of expertise than anybody else in the world, even if that is a very narrow area. So it is good to combine that breadth and depth as you kind of build up your expertise.
Yeah. This is useful. Yeah, definitely. And one last question I have before we try to wrap up is, as you mentioned, you pretty much started at a stage where we didn't see much more of an AI-based whole hype, where we didn't have a lot of technologies which were solely relying or maybe majorly relying on AI technologies. But with the transition of new hardware, lots of improvisations, we now have AI technologies which can be pretty much developed and used by a lot of a lot of naive researchers or maybe naive people who are not even in the computer science domain. So you saw a transition into how AI came into place and how it will look like in the next few years. I see there is always a concern where people are concerned who are not from a technical perspective about the idea of automations, that, hey, AI is going to automate a lot of stuff, a lot of jobs are going to replace or maybe diminished by these kind of technologies. And you are also working with a lot of collaborators who are not from computer science domain. They don't necessarily understand how these statistical algorithms or mathematical models work. So do you have any comment on that particular concern that people, or we always see in this news media articles, right, like clickbaity articles, where they try to point out that, hey, AI-based tools are taking away the jobs for radiologists or something like menial jobs that people have that can be replaced using these statistical algorithms. So can you comment in your sense, when you have seen the whole shift from how AI was at zero versus how it's now currently, and you're working on different interdisciplinary collaborators, can you comment, like, how much do you think the balance lies? Where do you think would be the ideal scenario?
Yeah, so I think one of the things, I think there is a need for us as computer scientists, as AI researchers and so on, right, to take a more holistic perspective and look for ways in which we develop AI technologies and we kind of develop solutions in a manner that is augmenting human capacity rather than trying to replace humans, right? So I think it is much more important as we are developing these tools in health, in, let's say, you're looking at learning and so on, right? I mean, the more you can think about how do you ultimately help doctors make good decisions, you help the teachers become more effective, you help, again, the learners learn more. So I think it is also very important for us as AI researchers and practitioners to approach these problems in a more responsible manner. And at the same time, I would also say that, I mean, as you look at the whole era of industrialization and so on, right, it has always led to changes, right, where there are certain kinds of jobs that start becoming less relevant, but in place of those jobs, right, there are newer jobs that emerge, and hopefully you are creating greater opportunities for, again, humans to do higher level, more meaningful kinds of work, so that even if some of those other jobs start to go away or become less relevant and so on, right? You are providing. But I think ultimately there has to be the right balance, because I do not believe it is right for us as computer scientists to say, my job is to develop technology, how that technology gets used, whether for good or bad, that's not my problem. I don't think that's the attitude that we should be taking. We should be looking at ourselves ultimately as, again, responsible citizens, and we should ourselves be thinking about the implications, the societal implications and so on, right? The human implications of the work that we are doing, and do our work in a manner, right, that we are ultimately helping humans overall, right, rather than trying to simply whatever take jobs away from humans and so on, or trying to simply, like, let's say, add to the bottom line of the company, of your organization and so on, right, at the expense of kind of quality of human life.
Yeah. This is something I really like, and this is gonna stay at least for me a lot. So I really love this perspective, and I think overall, like, this particular podcast, I covered a lot of topics, and this is frankly a lot of good insights that I learned, because I think we covered from a lot of different topics, being from a naive researcher to senior researcher to management, talking about the futures and how we can address these challenges at a bigger scale, like India. And India is one of the biggest population diversity that we find on this planet. So I mean, this is something a lot to take in. So yeah, this is something very useful, I find, and I'm gonna bookmark a lot of points that you covered. That at least I really like the idea of particularly zooming out, as in something I have been realizing a lot for myself, which I really love, and I love your insights on that particular thing. But apart from that, I don't have any more questions for you, and I think we are fairly slightly out of time. So I'll just thank you, and I'll leave a link to most of your works, and I think a homepage that you have, so that people who want to learn more about these projects, or maybe follow you in terms of what projects or works that you are publishing out, so that they can keep tuned to it. But apart from that, I really thank you. I really thank you. I think it's a bad timing for, like, at least the time zones that we have. So I really appreciate you doing at a very oddly hour. So I really thank you for doing this. And I hope people who are listening or tuning into this podcast find this useful. So thanks once again for doing this podcast.
Thanks again, Jay. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope this was of interest, of some use to you, as well as the other people who are listening to this. Thank you.